by Senator Rohde and Representative Meekins. At this time, I'll turn the teleconference over.
We need to get a mic for those people that are going to testify.
This Representative Meekins from Juneau, with us today from the House Committee on Loans and HFC and ADA would be Representative Bettesworth, Representative Halford, Representative Miller, and Representative Buchholz is a member of the committee and is on her way to the meeting. Will be here very soon. Just like to welcome everybody here. We had a last minute change on the because of some planes didn't make it in, and we're now teleconferencing. I hope that the people in Anchorage that were trying to get here did have a chance to know that they can show up at the information office and give us their testimony. The purpose of this meeting would be to take testimony from primarily from HFC and the interested parties who are part of the industry that are affected by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation program, and just get a general overview for the members of the committee on both sides of what's going on, what the problems are, and what we're going to be looking at for the next legislative session. With that, I'll turn the microphone over to Senator Rohde, who's chairman of the Senate committee.
Thanks, Russ. We have a rule that whoever's space we use gets to talk first. So if we use the Senate space next time for the meeting, I'll get a chance to talk first. With us today are Senator Mulcahy and Senator Stimson. Senator Sertoluski will join us momentarily. What I'd like to do today is take a look at several of the agencies that the Banking Committee will be dealing with. First, the agency that has a greater impact on more Alaskans than anyone else, and that's AHFC. I think we'll probably be lucky if we can just take a look at how our home mortgage program is working, where it's been, where it's going, and what we have to do. And with that, I think the best thing to do is to hear from those people who actually handle the program, and a program that I think has run very well, and one that I'm particularly proud of as a legislator since I chaired the pre-conference committee that set it up. Mr. Meekins, if it's agreeable with you, perhaps we could have Mr. Goldbar and his staff join us at the table.
Maybe.
While they're coming up and we're arranging the microphone for them so that the persons on the network can hear their testimony also, I just mentioned that we are in the House Finance Committee room, which seats about, I'd say, 40 people, and it looks to be almost full, so we've got quite an audience here, not only people from AHFC, but I see some of the familiar faces that have stayed up into the wee hours of the night on some of the other years trying to get this legislation in order. I'd just like to mention that for the people on the network. We do have quite an audience here. And some of the legislators who are not in attendance have sent their representatives or their aides. I see someone from Representative Montgomery's office and also the Speaker's office. And Representative Buchholz has joined us also. With that, I turn it over to HFC. You want your names for the record? We're taping.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Harry Goldbar. I'm the director of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. On my right is Mark Cameron, who is the director of finance for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And a brief overview and summary of what we've done in the last year. We should take fiscal year 1981. Which was not the same for HFC as it was for the rest of the state, but we'll take the entire 12-month period. HFC committed $750 million in mortgage purchase funds through the utilization of $610 million in bond proceeds and $183 million in appropriations. There were obviously some funds that carried over into this fiscal year. So far in fiscal year 1982, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has purchased $555 million in mortgages, and we've sold $500 million in bonds to include $300 million in taxable bonds and the entire portion of tax-exempt bonds allowed under federal legislation in the calendar year period, and that was $200 million. We anticipate total mortgage purchases in this fiscal year of slightly in excess of $900 million. In addition to that, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has structured a taxable bond issue and a tax-exempt bond issue, both the first of their kind by a state housing finance corporation, to support a market for second mortgages for purchase and second mortgages for home improvement, as directed by the legislature in the last session. We project a total mortgage demand for fiscal year 1982 of about $1.062 billion, I'm sorry, for FY83. That demand, mortgage purchase demand, should be supported by subsidy funds in the approximate amount of $283 million, which includes $133 million to be submitted in the governor's budget as a cash appropriation, and the rest of those funds will be derived by utilizing the proceeds from the $236 million in mortgage loans that were appropriated to HFC and on which the reversion was removed by the last session of the legislature. In addition, approximately $90 million will be requested to fund other programs that are not supported by bond proceeds. That includes the rural housing mortgage purchase program to the extent of $35 million, mobile home loan purchase program to the extent of $45 million, and the rural non-owner-occupied multifamily program. And all of these programs will be investments for the home ownership fund, which is for which we will request $90 million.
How much?
$90 million. And that's broken down, the rural mortgage program, the multifamily rural program, mobile home loan program, and investments for that $90 million. Same way we structured our appropriations request last year.
Yeah, this Russ Meekins up. That $90 million is in addition to the $283, is that correct?
The $90 million is in addition to it. No, the $90 million and the $133 million are what we're asking for in cash appropriations, right, Mr. Chair. If there are any specific questions or areas, topics that you would like us to address, Mr. Chair, we'll be glad to respond.
Yeah, I have a question for maybe some of the others. How is it that we appropriated some of our illiquid assets to you in the form of loans, right, a couple of years ago? And last year we took the reversion clause off, which allowed you to essentially not have to repay that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so I can understand why that might free up some money, but I don't understand why it hasn't been used already. I thought that was already used up, and it's surprising to me that it isn't.
No, that the appropriation of those mortgage loans was for the purpose of ensuring against the potential taxability of the $460 million in taxable bonds we sold under the shadow of the Ullman bill last year. We covenanted in our bond indentures to have that money available in the event of taxability until January 1st of 1983. Therefore, we cannot use those proceeds until that use, the covenant for that use is removed.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good news. If you add the 90 to the 133, you get 223 by my addition. So what would be the comparable figure for last year for those same programs of cash that we appropriated?
We'll see. Last year we requested, I believe, $222 million for the Special Mortgage Loan Purchase Program and $100 million for other programs, Home Ownership Fund and other programs.
Excuse me, it was 222 plus 43 for the other programs financed in connection with the Home Ownership Fund for a total of 265.
That's right. Getting more efficient. Yeah. You're one of the few agencies that gets more efficient with time. We're very pleased to see this, just to say.
Yeah, that is good news that we're doing substantially more. What, $100 million, or close to $100 million more in loans for
$40 million less, so that's the first time this budget season I've seen something go that way. Are there any questions from the committee?
I guess first question, Harry, could you give us the status of the second mortgage program, when you expect to go to bond, and when that money will then be available to the Alaskan public?
We had intended to sell bonds on January 20th. I think I sent a letter to Representative Halford and Phillips, and I thought I copied the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate, but I may have missed that step. We structured two issues for seconds, basically a taxable bond issue for second mortgages for purchase and second mortgages for home improvement, and a tax-exempt issue is allowed under the federal legislation for home improvement loans up to $15,000, a $15,000 maximum loan amount. We had intended to sell those bonds, if possible, on January 20th. At a board meeting here in Juneau on January 20th, the market typically was awry at the time, and we do have adequate funds that we could borrow from other funds to begin the programs without having to go to the bond market. So I recommended the board, and they determined to not go to market at that time to fund the programs. We were out. We had anticipated that we would be able to start the programs by about February 1st, and our bond council felt that we needed additional regulations before implementation of the programs. Therefore, we're out for public hearing on additional regulations to provide for the implementation of the second mortgage programs right now. The board will meet and determine whether or not to pass those regulations on February 17th. If the regulations are approved by the board, we should be able to implement the program almost immediately after February 17th.
The second mortgage program is important to my constituents, probably everybody's. One, because it will decrease housing demand, and because of high rates, it's of course an interest that many people have as an alternative to buying another house.
We should have it implemented no later than about February 20th.
I have another question with regard to multiplex financing. As you know, we've talked to the Great Green Legislature about providing additional specific authority for threeplexes, fourplexes, fiveplexes, sixplexes, specifically aimed at alleviating the rental market problem and providing rental housing. Could you give me I'll be asking later on for some specific language to implement that program, but could you give me a general overview of your feelings and some possible costs of the program?
Mark,
as I believe we have responded to a similar request from Jim Kelly of your office, and I don't recall the exact volume that we had estimated. I don't know. Jim, do you happen to have?
I don't think that ever was determined what the demand would be. There were some preliminary cost figures in terms of construction costs and some basic parameters given to what to outline for the program. For example, limiting it to fourplexes, limiting it to owner occupied, limiting the subsidy or making the subsidy equivalent to that which we now have to single and duplexes.
I believe I also in that same letter gave an estimate of what we felt the annual demand for the program would be, and somewhere around 40 to 60 million.
That was restricted to three and fourplex owner occupied, is that
right?
That figure?
Right.
But
new construction only, I believe.
Excuse me, Janelle, this is Anchorage.
Anchorage, this is Juno.
Would it be possible, guess me?
No, would you please?
I don't know. Who is that?
The committee members?
Teleconference, I think.
Anchors, did you remember that is the committee members?
That's a good idea. Most people sit in an anchor or something, that's the impression I got.
So it's just anchors.
Okay, thank you. We'll try to do the following, and we can do, I'll send this to you.
These microphones, please remember to keep, leave one microphone on at all times, and get the mouse a little closer to the microphone.
Good, yeah, good.
The top four of you is on.
If both of them are on, it makes it difficult for you to, for anchors.
Just one on.
Yeah.
One on my turn.
Perhaps as we look at this question later on, if it'd be possible for you to develop some specific language that would implement this program, and also some specific data regarding whether we should go up to six plexes or four plexes, or limited at four plexes. It's basically a financial and engineering question, not a legislative question, primarily, or I hope it is.
Yeah, I'd like to get into a couple of questions. Do you have any specific, you know, you talked about how much money you're going to need, and that's obviously going to take an appropriation, but are you also advocating any specific legislation in terms of statutory changes that you have discovered you need or that you recommend for changes?
We have been working on some language for a form of subsidy recapture for the program, which ultimately could result in a revolving fund concept, which I understand has been, there's some interest been expressed down here in revolving fund, revolving loan fund, or other forms of reducing the amount of subsidy. We will introduce that legislation, if at all, through the governor's office, and we're dealing with Mr. Lehrer in regard to specific language on that proposed legislation right now.
But, you know, one of the things that we usually find is when we're all done in our free conferencing with changing the statutes, about a couple months later, we find we made some mistakes that need to be changed. You don't have any of those kind of things this year, is that right? What about
any specific changes?
How about the Rogers Ratchet? Were you interested in doing anything about that?
The Rogers Ratchet has us in a position right now of having to expend subsidy to the extent of 705 basis points, 7.05% between what the cost of funds on our last taxable sale was and the mortgage rate that we've achieved through the workings of the Rogers Ratchet. And it hasn't worked in as orderly a manner as I think any of us would have liked, but the activity of the Rogers Ratchet is created by the chaotic activity in the bond market. We project that if the market continues to go in the direction it's gone, that we will be able to reduce that subsidized spread by down to about 5 to 5.5%. But at this point, we can't even anticipate when we're going to be in a position where the spread has been reduced to 3% and we begin to have a regular and expectable subsidy. I don't have any suggestions at this time for it, in regard to changing the Rogers Ratchet in response to bond markets. If the Rogers Ratchet is to be changed legislatively, I think we would have to proceed toward a 3% spread by using a 0.5% a month or some predictable formula to get us there. The bond market is simply too chaotic and has been to predict where we're going any more than a week from now.
Thank you. I believe Representative Halford has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question is with regard to the Rogers Ratchet. If you can, under your current regulatory structure, provide for a rate, an interest rate at the time of commitment versus at the time of closing, so that people know exactly what they're going to get, or if there would be some method by which the Rogers Ratchet effect could be delayed. Say the interest rate were set biannually following the Rogers Ratchet, but not hitting a change in interest rate where somebody has basically sold one house and in the process of closing another house finds that they don't qualify for the transaction that they'd set up?
We have drafted a basic procedure that is possible to use with the approval of our board for implementing an individual commitment. And under that plan, AHFC will be enabled to commit on an individual basis to an interest rate.
When do you expect your board will be taking that up?
When's the scheduled meeting after February 7th? That's on the other one.
We'll probably put that on the agenda for the February 17th meeting.
Thank you.
I have another question with regard to pending legislation. There's a proposal that all criteria you use in making your loans be put in regulation form. I have some difficulty with that, having some knowledge of banking. Do you view that as a proposal that you could work with and live with?
Are you speaking specifically of SB 609, I believe it is?
Yes.
If we were concerned when we saw that bill that the effect of it would be to require a seller servicer guide to be in regulation form. I think it would make it very cumbersome for us to try to continue to maintain a viable and expeditious turnaround in our prior approvals and mortgage purchases, and also a smooth relationship with the seller servicers if we had our seller servicer guide in regulation form. First of all, it requires some interpretation, and at least currently that interpretation tends to be more liberal on the side of the borrower than it used to be, and we feel it would take away some of the flexibility and the ability to change our guidelines when we find that we've made a mistake or when conditions have changed. If we had to go out through the regulation hearing process each and every time we wanted to change a word in the seller servicer guide, it'd be very cumbersome.
But just let me comment that when we set this up, AHFC in its present form, that one of the concerns we had was that AHFC should operate as much like a private entity as possible while pursuing the public good. And if this issue was talked about at that time, and it was the desire to give you the flexibility, and that's why I raised the question, since now it's at least possible that some people might wish to restrict that flexibility.
Senator Mulcahy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to pursue a little bit further, if I could, something that Senator Rohde had got off on. And you mentioned on the second mortgage that you had other funds available. There's obviously a great deal of interest out there in this program as it comes online. And I was wondering that how long you expect those funds to last, just what is this amount that of other funds, and then what do you anticipate the demand to be? That we've had a lot of conversation in the past that put a lot of question marks on just how much that demand was going to be. And I've been in communication with your office, and I understand that the program is not such that would extract equity out of refinancing with a second mortgage or I guess I'd call it playthings and stuff like that, but for actual home additions. And I appreciate some information along that line, Mr. Goldman.
We have funds available from prepayments, from unrestricted prepayments from other programs. We do keep liquid cash investments in order to be able to meet bond amortization payments in the event that a program doesn't specifically support it or support it in a timely manner. Those are the types of funds we intend to apply to do the startup pending bond sale for the second mortgages. And no, we haven't structured the programs, and we didn't believe it was the legislative intent to structure the programs to include equity extraction. We're talking about programs that are structured specifically. The proceeds from the taxable bond sale will be used for both second mortgages for purchase and for home improvement, and from the tax-exempt bond sale for home improvement only, up to $15,000.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, just to follow on a little bit, I was kind of curious if you feel that the other funds that you have available, Harry, are going to be sufficient to meet the demand, I guess, until you go out to the bond market.
Yes, we do. It's one of the reasons that we felt very comfortable with recommending the board that we not go to the market when it was as bad as it was at our last board meeting. We're watching the market on a daily basis, along with our financial advisors and underwriters over, have been and we will continue to over about the next 6 weeks. There is anticipated to be a quotes window, end quotes, in the market when the rates will subside, and we're going to try to enter that window when the opportunity arises. In the meantime, we will have adequate funds. Martin, you have even a ballpark figure you can give the senator?
It would funds that were appropriated from the state that are in the, called the State Assisted Mortgage Fund totaled $158 million at December 31, 1981. And those funds will eventually be used for subsidization of loans, and some of those represent prepayments of mortgages that were pledged to those two tax-exempt sales in 1980 that totaled $460 million. And we would not anticipate the demand for the second programs that are being the bond financing is being delayed to be even probably $10 million between the day it's implemented and when we would sell the bonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You said that you're anticipating next year $1,062 million in loan demand. Is that correct for the basic program?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Could you break that down by? I assume $200 million. That's going to be the allowable tax exempt under the Ullman bill. If I'm correct, tell me if that's true, and also break down how the other's coming and in what form.
Okay, the schedule. I'll read it to you and. This sort of gives proposed bond sales during fiscal year 1983. There would be, we propose four bond sales for the first mortgage revenue bond program, the taxable program, $150 million, $120, $120, $150 for a total of $540 million. The second mortgage revenue bond program, the taxable program, we would estimate three bond sales. Two at $50 million and the third at $25 million for a total of $125 million. And the tax exempt, the tax exempt second mortgage revenue bonds, we would estimate two issues at $20 million each. And the first mortgage revenue bonds, the tax exempt, which we recently sold $200 million under the 1981 authorization, we would estimate two sales of $70 and $75 million for a total of $145 million. The total of all those bond sales is the requested increased bond authorization, which we were asking for FY83 of $850 million. And the balance of the $1,062 million would be from prepayments under other programs and from the $133 million in cash. Requested as direct subsidy appropriation for that year.
I'm sorry, could you go over that again? After the 850, you got 133, and what was the other one?
The other one was these. We have outstanding over $1 billion in bonds that are structured on a 30-year mortgage basis, and to the extent that we receive prepayments in those programs, we can refunnel them into new mortgages, and the difference between the 850, 133, and the $1,062 million, we would expect to come out of those prepayments.
That would be the difference between 850 plus the one.
Right.
Does
roughly $100 million, and then the difference being costs of financing those or selling those $850 million in bonds, which would come out of the net bond or the bond proceeds.
Okay, thank you. And also, which ones are, or I'm interested in the $150 million. That's the proceeds from, you said that you need $283 million to get to the $1 billion figure, and $133 million is in cash, and $150 million was what, proceeds from loans, or it was loans that we've appropriated to you and that they're being paid back, paybacks on those loans?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's a combination of cash that will remain and mortgages that will exist on January 1983 that were originally appropriated in 1980 to the program. Original appropriation, if you recall, was $236 million in mortgage loans, $105 million in cash. We utilized in subsidy funds of that for the tax-exempt issues roughly $50 million, and the balance is available for release. And what that number represents is sort of the present value of those below-market mortgages that we would use as subsidy funds.
Okay, but what you're going to use that money for is for a subsidy, right? I mean, you're going to go to the bond market, and then you're going to use that to reach the rate that you lend it at. Is that correct, or am I wrong?
Correct. But what will occur is we'll sell the first taxable sale, $150 million, in fiscal year 1983, to be able to pay the higher rate on the bonds over what we will be putting the mortgages out at. We will have to transfer in, let's say, $50 million of these additional mortgages or mortgages that lapse back to the corporation. So there'll be a pool of mortgages of roughly $200 million, the cash flow of which will be utilized to pay the debt service on the bonds.
Thank you. Any other questions?
One last question. The Home Ownership Fund, it was developed several years ago, and provides for first-time low-income moderate people, first-time buyers. Been very popular among my constituents. Do you have any suggestions as to what the legislature, if anything, should do to the Home Ownership Fund this year?
Just fund it, please. We are in the process of restructuring the Home Ownership Fund right now. We have not had a lot of pressure on the amount of money that we've had in the Home Ownership Fund, and we feel that the way we were originally structured is simply not reaching out to as many potential purchasers under the fund as we could. And we have, since our volume has decreased to some extent during the winter months here, we have a couple of our folks working on restructuring that program so that we will utilize it to the maximum and reach a few more potential buyers.
I'm sure the whole committee would like to work with you on that during the session. It is very important, particularly to people of modest means, and is one of the mechanisms by which a person that had not previously owned a house can actually afford to buy a house in Alaska.
I'd like to get back to the question of three triplexes and fourplexes. Are you currently authorized to do that? What's the situation there?
I believe, as a matter of fact, under our current enabling legislation for the Special Mortgage Loan Purchase Program, we're restricted to single family residences and duplexes owner occupied. That would require additional legislation.
Representative Buckle.
Do I need this gadget here?
Push it forward.
Push this thing forward.
Okay, on the single dwelling, you're talking, you're being restricted for single dwelling. Duplexes, what is the status of loans for condominium buying? It looks like condominium is quite popular in our areas, in Anchorage at least. And what is the status of that? How much money is needed, if any? And how many loans have been made to borrowers to buy condominiums?
Condominiums are eligible properties for mortgages under Special Mortgage Loan Purchase Program and the Home Ownership Fund. There are statistics on page 30 of the booklet that we passed out that indicates the breakdown of loans, single-family residence, condominium, and so on.
Yeah, page 30 and 31 also. 31 gives the summary for the 6 months ending December 31, 1981.
I have heard you have run out of money. Is that true? I mean, of course, there are people that have been talking about borrowing, and they've been told that the test closed because you have run out of money.
I have personally, but the corporation has not.
We've been discussing on the House side, and I believe there's some thought on the Senate side also of trying to do something about the multifamily problem that several cities in the state are having, Anchorage among one, Juneau another one. And part of that would involve deciding whether ADA or HFC were to do it. And seems like a logical distinction might be to have HFC go to three and four plexes, and then have anything larger than that be under the auspices of ADA. My question is, what do you think of that in terms of a division? And secondly, are you do you have any position on whether that's something that the agency would like to take on? And thirdly, what are we talking about in terms of money, and specifically, what would the difference? We're saving 40 some million in terms of comparing to last year's appropriations for your programs. What could you do with 40 million? Could you make any dent in it?
As far as the position on how to divide this, the approach to multifamily, we've talked with Senator Rohde and Mr. Kelly on several occasions in regard to three and fourplex owner occupied. We feel that our program can accommodate it fairly well. As to money amounts, I think they're included in the letter to Mr. Kelly that Mr. Cameron sent it as of December 28. As far as whether or not HFC should do the larger multifamily complexes, Commissioner Williams is here, and he's on both boards, and I think he might more adequately answer that question, since it's one of a probably broader policy than I really should address.
Okay, that sounds like a good idea, but according to what Jim's saying, then you were talking about 30 to 50 million, is that right? So this only involves the House's calculations, but what we're looking at is not exceeding the dollar figure that we spent last year for all loans, including HFC loans, but also the other loan programs that we have but aren't under your auspices. And in that regard, then, if we're trying to keep everybody relatively equal, you're asking for $43 or $42 million less than last year, something around there. So that could be then used for the triplexes and fourplexes, then, is if I'm understanding your point here, and do fairly good at covering the demand, or what? What do you think?
Actually, the cost would probably be less than that. The question is one of what would be the source of money, and then what would be the subsidy. And you don't know the subsidy because you don't know what you buy. Presumably, you buy your bonds at. So I realize it's difficult. But do you have a ballpark figure for the actual out-of-pocket cost for the legislature? Which is what we understand best.
Right. What we've done is looked at what the program may look like, and based on some rough assumptions that it would only include triplex and fourplexes, that the program would be limited to only new construction, 20% down payment would be required, there'd be no secondary financing allowed, owner occupancy would also be a requirement. An estimate that the construction cost per unit would be roughly $50,000. We estimated a total demand for that program of between 30 and 50 million, with subsidy, depending on what the bond market looks like at the time, of 12 to 20 million.
Senator Sturzalewski.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I apologize for being late. I was at another committee meeting where they were considering a bill that was rather important. I really appreciate the comments that apparently were made earlier regarding the second mortgage program. I'm glad that's going ahead. I wanted to specifically ask for the ties into this total amount of dollars available. There's a bill that had been introduced by Senator Bradley that speaks to one of the provisions still available under the Ullman bill, which allows for general obligation bond funding for veterans programs. If that bill were to pass and we were to go with the voters and the voters pass a program so that we could use GO bonds for veterans housing, would that impact some of the programs you have and possibly lessen the subsidy that were necessary to come up with and still do the volume of business that you're indicating may be before us next year?
It will reduce the amount of subsidy that the corporation requires. We estimate that about 30% of our borrowers are eligible veterans. It will require some other enabling legislation, of course, and probably a different definition of veteran than the current state definition of eligible veteran, because we're almost certain that the federal government is going to require us to follow the federal government's definition of veteran.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, we've done some work to take a look at that, and our legal advisors say that the effect of the wording would be the same as it's indicated in the bill. I'd like any information that you might have made available through the committee to us on the veterans program and how much we might be talking about in lessened subsidies, as well as what actually will be needed to be done and possibly in other legislation so that that program could go, and perhaps some estimate of if the voters did vote on that and approved it, what we might be talking about in terms of implementing the program. Thank you.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea.
Thank you.
If there are one more question, Representative Buckle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps this is not time to bring it up, but maybe it's timely because there was a resolution introduced in the House yesterday claiming discrimination on the part of AHFC, two other agencies, in terms of their lending practices. And I don't know whether this body will be addressing this resolution or that if there will be hearing on this at all, but the alleged discrimination of lending practices by agencies such as AFHC, which we are now having meetings with, could you tell me if you find that to be a real problem in terms of various individuals borrowing and they don't get the application, they claim discrimination? When they don't get it, because maybe they are either young, they're old, they are of racial minority, or they're just, you know, different levels, different criteria. Could you address that issue?
We are a secondary mortgage market, of course. We don't come into personal contact with very many of the borrowers that go to the lending institutions, the banks and mortgage companies, in order to apply for a loan. However, I don't recall any specific complaints alleging discrimination in the last year or so that I've been at last year in the Finance Corporation. I did participate in the teleconference hearings that were held at the behest of the Anchorage chapter of the NAACP, I believe. We were unable to determine any specific allegations of discrimination or any specific substance to those allegations. I spoke with one of Representative Martin's aides this morning, and we're going to try to compile some statistical information, or at least that amount of statistical information that we're allowed to compile under federal laws in regard to the ethnic makeup of mortgages purchased. We have no way at this time of determining what the breakdown is ethnically or in any other form of those mortgages that are never sent up to us for prior approval, that are turned away at the lending institution.
May I continue on?
Please do.
What I have heard, of course, is that the banks, either the bank approves of it, there's no money with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation encourages the application and the banks turn it down. So perhaps this has to be clarified, because I'm not sure which one is the real culprit in this case, if there is any. It might be just the applicant, very overly sensitive, but I think this is an interesting issue to address, since the majority coalition in the House has come up with House Resolution Number 17. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
One of the questions that Representative Buckle had been asking previously was something about being out of money. Now, it just reminded me, I got a letter from someone, and I think it was resolved finally, but it really wasn't a question of being out of money, but they thought it was, and had something to do with the bank they had gone to not being, I think for the rural program, not being a seller servicer. It was at one time, and then it wasn't, and then you guys got a ruling from the AG or something that put it back. Am I reminding you of anything that actually happened? That's what I understood to be the case.
Yes, I don't think have we gotten that ruling yet? We did.
The lenders can talk on Monday.
Yes, the interpretation of the to participate. We've gotten a clarification of that legislation, that statute, and commercial lenders, mortgage companies, others are allowed to participate in that program now.
If there are no further questions, perhaps it would be appropriate to...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Bedworth.
Yeah, I have several questions, if I may. Representative Buckholt raised the question about being out of funds, and you haven't really fully answered what the status is right now of lendable funds for mortgage applicants, how long it's going to last, and at what point the legislature is going to need to address the new appropriation so we don't have that flux period sometime at the beginning of the building season, get all our builders and suppliers all up in the air, if you follow me, which I think you probably do.
We are, as a matter of fact, we testified this morning in front of Representative Cuddy's subcommittee on the House side. We are requesting an additional $210 million in supplemental bond authorization, not additional appropriations. We've found some innovative bond structures, or structures to our bond issues that have allowed us to continually reduce the amount of subsidy that we're having to apply to any given bond issue. So we are requesting additional bond authorization. We are not requesting additional appropriated subsidy. We're also asking for $850 million in bond authorization for FY83, which I think I commented on earlier, and the amount of appropriated subsidy that we indicated, $133 million for Special Mortgage Loan Purchase Program. Mark, could you give a breakdown very quickly, please, of the funds available for mortgage purchase?
Under the Special Mortgage Loan Purchase Program, we currently have approximately $180 million that is available for commitments to the banks for mortgage purchases. And we would expect that to be utilized somewhere between April and May, and we would enter the bond market again sometime subsequent to that. Currently, without additional bond authorization, we would allocate the $92 million that we have available for additional bond sales to $27 million for the second mortgage taxable sale, $15 million for the tax exempt home improvement bond issue, and $50 million for state assisted mortgage bonds series F and G. And we would either use that $50 million to get us through the year, or hopefully with the additional bond authorization and remaining subsidy funds available, would be able to meet the demand anticipated through the end of June.
Okay, then you believe that you have enough funds on hand and available through additional bond sales to carry you through this fiscal year?
Yes.
Based on historical records and so forth over the last two or three years?
That is correct.
So if our builders start getting panicking, wanting to know if there's going to be funds, we can tell them it appears there will be through June.
Correct.
Okay, another question if I may, Mr. Chairman. You made predictions of a level of approximately $1,062,000 that would take four bond issues. In order to arrive at those projections, you must have had to put down an anticipated bond cost, or average bond, what you'd have to pay. With the market fluctuating like it is, what average figure did you use to arrive at those projections?
Because of the 1981 legislation that effectively put a cap on the level of subsidy that we can incur, the figure of 7.05%, we utilized a figure somewhat just below that, and the amount of subsidy is more dependent on mortgage volume than where rates are at that time, since any increased rate would be passed on to the borrower.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, but okay, you're saying the subsidy can't increase much over what it was this peak last year, so that your guesstimation, so to speak, is just below that for this year. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Right. Correct.
Okay. That concludes my questions for the time. Thank you.
If there are no more questions, perhaps it would be appropriate at this time to hear from the Commissioner of Revenue. We don't want to keep the Commissioner waiting too long. Very important man in this process.
While you're changing places there, could I ask you to work with my staff and getting some language on 3 or 4 plexus authorization that might take?
Thank you very much.
No, I just have to ask somebody to.
They didn't know.
No.
Williams would probably know better than.
I mean, we can use the hand deal to get the time.
We need the question.
So I just throw the switchboard. I don't have to press it down and throw the phone.
No.
Give the wrong response to this electrical shock.
I'm aware of that. I sat in this chair before.
I'll be right back.
Thank you. What do you want me to talk about? Pat, what do you want me to talk about?
If I can go ahead and start off by asking the commissioner a question. You, I think, wear as many hats as any member of the administration on the board of ADA, AHFC, and the Permanent Fund. The first question I would like to ask is one that relates to the implementation of the Veterans General Obligation Bond Program. If you could give us your perspective on that, as being responsible for the state general obligation bonds, I'm sure the program has caused you a great deal of thought.
Yes, it has, Mr. Chairman. As you know, the Ullman bill is essentially what has curtailed AHFC's ability to raise tax-exempt financing. It's called the Ullman bill because Representative Ullman of Oregon was the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee in the U.S. Congress and was the author of the legislation. And even though he did away with revenue bond issuers' tax-exempt status or curtailed it, such as AHFC, he kept his own state's program intact. Under Oregon's Constitution, general obligation bonds of the state may be issued for purposes of funding loans for veterans. So that provision was not affected at all in the legislation that Mr. Ullman wrote. unfortunately, I suppose, in one sense, for acting to exploit that beneficial feature that still exists in the Internal Revenue Code, Mr. Ullman did not get reelected by his constituency, notwithstanding the fact that he had helped them so admirably. So it's now Mr. Rostenkowski of Illinois, who, and I don't think Illinois has a general obligation veterans program in its constitution. Nevertheless, the law is on the books, and if it is taken advantage of, it would mean that for veterans who qualify under the program within the federal definition of veterans, that we would be able to issue bonds at a tax-exempt rate instead of a taxable rate for their mortgages. Now, one of the mistakes that has happened in the case of Oregon, I think, is that they've issued the bonds in the name of the state of Oregon. And they've issued millions and millions and millions of these bonds for the veterans' housing in their own name. And then, of course, they had their regular state capital projects that they also issued general obligation bonds for. The problem is that the market is just filled up with general obligation bonds bearing this name, Oregon. The state of Oregon pledges its full faith and credit and so on. And I think their credit rating has been impaired. I think they're paying higher interest rates than if they'd gone another way, which is a way that I would recommend that we go. Still would involve a pledge of the full faith and credit of the state, and that would be the ultimate guarantee. But I think it would be good if the bonds were issued in the name of an instrumentality of the state, such as Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, with the guarantee of the state's full faith and credit behind it. That way they are still general obligation bonds of the state. They do count, in a sense, against the state's ultimate credit-issuing capacity, but I don't think they count as directly, and I think they will have a better market reception. And the reason for that is this. Bondholders like to have security on two things. Number one, they want to know for sure they're going to be paid. And number two, they want to be sure they're going to be paid on time. And, of course, number three is they want to make sure that their tax-exempt status is unaffected, too. But that's not going to be an issue here. The thing is the first two. If you have the instrumentality, such as AHFC, and I'll use that by way of an example, if AHFC were to issue bonds with a state moral or general obligation guarantee of those bonds, you have standing behind those bonds, first of all, the mortgages that are being made to the veterans. That's your first source of security. Of course, the bondholder says, well, what happens if you start having a bad economic situation in there in the state and the veterans are defaulting? Well, then you have whatever reserves that AHFC would have set up with some of the proceeds of the bonds pursuant to the covenants that they would make with the bondholders and the indenture for the issuance of those bonds. So there would be cash reserves then of the corporation that would be available and backing those bonds. Also as part of the security might or might not have been some insurance that AHFC could have purchased. With the state's general obligation, the insurance is probably gilding the lily. But it would be a conceivable additional source of security that AHFC would bring to satisfy the bondholders. Finally, there would be the general assets of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, those assets that are not pledged or committed for any other bond purpose. Presumably, the corporation, since it's its own bonds that would be issued, would draw on those before notifying the state that it was unable to discharge the obligations and meet debt service on one of these guaranteed bonds. With adequate notice, say of 30 or 45 days or maybe 60 days, of a pending default by AHFC, an inability on their part, all those safety nets have failed, then and only then is a call placed on the state. It's a paramount call on the state's assets, and at that point we liquidate investments or whatever may be required to come up with the funds for that debt service. But with that lead time, it would even be possible to call a special session of the legislature if it were necessary, change the tax laws, and issue revenue anticipation notes for the state if it actually came down to a cataclysmic doomsday scenario. So there is then the assurance not only that it's going to be paid, that's the full faith and credit of the state there, the full taxing power of the state is behind those bonds. But in addition, there is this, these additional assurances to make sure that the payments will be on time. And I think the resources that AHFC brings into the picture on its own adds a dimension that will facilitate market acceptance, and I think we will be looking at lower rates and perhaps an even a higher bond rating than we would have had if they were just simply in the state's own name.
Commissioner, Senator Sturzaluski has a question.
To pursue that, and I'm glad to see the discussion. That's why I raised it. I think it's very intriguing, but I'm wondering, let's assume that we use an instrumentality, and obviously HFC is the logical one, and the full faith and credit of the state was behind it. First of all, just considering today's bond market, I wonder what we're talking about in terms of rate. Let's say that there's no subsidy in and it's just a quid pro quo. Whatever we sell, that's what's passed along. Mr. Commissioner, the second part of that would be, what impact might... Okay, the second part of the question would be, what impact would the issuing of those bonds possibly have on the other credit of AHFC? You're talking about certain things backing the bonds and one thing another. Would that impact in any way the taxable bonds that they're currently issuing? In other words, would we have a relationship between their ability to go with the tax-exempt bonds versus what they're already doing?
Well, first of all, with respect to the question about the interest rate, probably the bonds would sell in the range of 11 to 11 and a half.
I see.
The seller's seller servicer, the bank's servicing fee would be tacked on to that. But you're really not talking about an extremely high rate as you are with conventional mortgage sources. The second part of the question as to whether such a program would affect AHFC's ability to issue bonds on its own under its other programs, I don't think that it's necessarily going to be a consequence of such a general obligation bond program that AHFC's abilities would be impaired in that regard. It grows bigger and bigger, and as it grows, the return, you know, there is a spread that is allowed for AHFC on some of its older portfolio between what its cost of funds was when it raised the tax-exempt bonds or issued them and what it turned around and loaned it for. And that is money that is coming back in. And as those loans are being repaid, those go to the general assets of AHFC. And they either can be used, consumed, for instance, as subsidy loans to back other taxable bonds funded mortgages, or they can be invested directly and just remain assets of AHFC as general assets. But whichever way they're done, the security and safeguards for the present program are all set forth in the indenture. And the bond resolution, the master resolution authorizing those bonds, we wouldn't contemplate changing that. So the same degree of security would be available and would be provided from AHFC's assets.
If I could follow up two questions. One, would there be any difference at all in the selling price of a bond issued by the state of Alaska or by an instrumentality? And secondly, would demand peak early on for veterans loans and then tend to decline after scale?
I don't believe there would be that there should be any difference between being issued by an instrumentality with a guarantee of the full faith and credit of the state of Alaska behind it, if the state of Alaska issues it in its own name. The security features that are available are comparable. If anything, there's a little extra dimension there because of the assets that AHFC can bring into the table. So it seems to me that at least we should be looking at a comparable interest rate. But I think the advantage of using an instrumentality from the state's point of view is I think it preserves bonding capacity for the state that otherwise may be consumed by massive issues for veterans housing. As for the demand, I suppose the demand would be largely a question of relative advantage in interest rates under existing programs that AHFC has that are served by veterans, and what the interest rate would be under this general obligation bond program, assuming it's authorized by the voters. If there's a significant difference in those rates, you'll see veterans leaving the regular AHFC program and going to the more advantageous rates that are available through the tax-exempt program. And to the extent that there would be that shift, I think that would be a preliminary shift, and then you would you'd probably see things settle back down. Also, depends on what the state of the economy is going to be then. If people are afraid that things are about to run away and get out of hand, they might take an interest rate that they're really higher than they'd like to see, but they don't see it getting any more advantageous. And so there could be that sort of phenomenon too. But after, if there were an initial spurt, I would expect it to level off fairly quickly and be steady demand after that.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Maybe I missed something, but I don't even understand why there would be this spurt. Right now, we're loaning out monies last year and this year at 11 and a half, highly subsidized monies under the Geobond veterans loan thing, as I understand it. We could loan these out non-subsidized at, you indicated, 11 or 11 and a half. So from a veteran standpoint, why would he transfer over to the why would he close out his old loan under the existing program and hop on this new one when, the from his standpoint, the interest is in approximately the same neighborhood anyway?
One of the reasons would be is that the interest is the same only on the first $90,000 of the mortgage.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And second is that under the way the AHFC interest rates work, is that base rate on the subsidized portion of $90,000 does not decrease, even though bond rates may come down, until the subsidy differential reaches 3 percentage points. So it would be possible to have quite a rally in the bond market before that 7.05% spread of subsidy now is narrowed down to 3, and so that could offer quite an opportunity for tax-exempt bonds to be below 10, for instance, before we actually saw any significant drops in the base rate on the subsidized portion under the ratchet.
Yeah. Would you walk me through that last part again? I got detoured.
Well, it goes back to how the ratchet works. It's called a ratchet because every time you have an increase in interest rates on the bonds that the corporation issues, the interest rate on the borrowers and for the first 90,000 moves up by the same number of percentage points. If you have a bond sale that comes down, you have, let's say we had a sale at 18% and the next sale came at 17%, the base rate, let's say it was 12.5, would not move down the 1 percentage point. It would stay at 12.5. What would happen is that for borrowers over $90,000, instead of paying 18% on that excess, they'd only be paying 17% on that excess. So their blended rate or composite rate, if they're borrowing more than 90, would move down on average. But it would only be until, if again, using 12.5 as where the ratchet part is, it would only be until the bond rate got down to 15.5%. And then if it continued any lower, 15.25, then the subsidized part would go down from 12.5 down to 12.25 and would then be paralleling it at 300 basis points or 3 percentage points.
3%. One last question, Mr. Chairman, if I may. What opportunities do you see in this, if any, in multifamily? In other words, what I'm trying to get at is, could a veteran, for instance, borrow under the terms of the Ullman exclusion and this general obligation device we're talking about, could a veteran borrow money for an eightplex or even an apartment house? You see that, or are we strictly talking about single-family residences in this case?
I don't really know, but I haven't heard any discussions about veterans being able to do multifamily housing under the veterans exception. So I think the answer is probably no, they could not.
Thank you. Thank
you, Mr. I'd like to go back to that multifamily question and ask you, as we're in all the different responsibilities you have, to tell us what
what your position or the administration's position or however you want to define it is in terms of going to multifamily. I think there's a, I'm very interested in doing that, and I think that with the limit that we're working up with on the House side, we've got a limit of $400 million for everything, and however we want to allocate that to get the most out of it for loan programs is sort of up to the committee to make recommendations. And it seems to me within that, with some of the good news we've heard, we've got some money that might be able to be used for going into that multifamily area. And what do you know about that? I've heard there might even be an exemption in the Ullman bill for a multifamily, but it's got that some sort of low-income connections with it, too. And then ADA may or may not be able to do multifamily. Could you just respond to that basic area?
Certainly. Well, first of all, I think that with respect to multifamily housing, the legislature can probably and should work closely with the municipalities. Anchorage, for instance, is considering a multifamily housing program that it may be able to develop on its own. There's been quite a lot of discussions about that, and as far as I know, they have not yet concluded that they're in a blind alley. I don't know whether they are seeing their way through the to the other side or not, but certainly there's progress being made there. And if they do succeed, that may well provide a paradigm that others can follow. Also, another problem that we have that exacerbates the multifamily housing and the low availability of rental units is conversions. We've seen right here in this town conversions of large apartment complexes into condominiums. And I'm told that there are over 200 units in Anchorage, or, well, primarily in Anchorage, but around the state, that are that would be converted into condominiums if Alaska Housing Finance Corporation would approve the condominium association and authorize those to be financed. So you run into kind of a devil in the deep blue sea here in the programs that AHFC has. On the one hand, we're encouraging condominiums, and we want them to be as an intermediate dwelling for people to move from being renters into ultimately individual homeowners. So there is a legitimate purpose and a need out there for condominium financing, which AHFC is supplying. At the same time, though, by allowing these conversions to go forward, it causes a tightening on the other side. Renters then get pinched out because they no longer can qualify to meet a mortgage payment, whereas they could have met the rent. And the landlord's solution to that is to try to jack that rent up as high as they can. Now, in the past, we've seen local governments take, I think, strong action to clamp down on unnecessary conversions over. And I would hope, again, that the legislature would consider either legislation on its own or communicating with the local governments the importance of, in a community where there is a critical shortage of rental housing available, that they use their zoning powers or their police powers either to prevent rent gouging so that they can get a vacancy factor that allows them to convert over, or to prevent the conversions outright from happening, at least for a moratorium period of time. We've seen that in the past, and it's worked successfully, and I think that that it can work again. So that's by way of prologue. Where the rest is epilogue. There is no substance between them.
I'm afraid of that.
That's what we found out last year when the governor vetoed our bill.
Well, as you recall, there was in fact a provision that the Industrial Development Authority financed mobile homes, and there was an appropriation of $20 million. I'm sorry, I said mobile homes, I mean multifamily. The problem was, of course, the $20 million got vetoed, and it seemed at the time, and I believe it still is, that it was grossly too little for the demand that is out there. If we're going to set a program up we probably are looking at a call on the order of $100 million, I think. There is a lot of pent-up demand. That was the figure that I recall being discussed in the legislature last year, and I don't know of anything that would have changed that. If anything, inflation will have nudged that up by 7 or 8%. And I think that if we're going to create a program like that, and we're going to provide it, whether it's at a subsidized rate or not, it needs to be endowed with enough money to do the job. With tax-exempt bonds, you do have real problems making the numbers work out right so that the unit looks as if it's going to, or the development looks as though it's going to be able to meet the debt service on the bonds that are issued. The reason for that is you have a requirement that X percent of that development be used for low-income housing. And that means low rents from that. And it just doesn't pencil out very, very easily. In fact, it's extremely hard to do. So about the only way that you could get something like that is to rig up another source of funds that is the true source of credit for what the bonds are. You're almost matching dollar for dollar so that the bondholders, instead of looking at the income stream coming from the housing development, will be looking at this other pool, and the income that may come in from the housing development proves to be gravy to the agency that's administering it. But that, I mean, ultimately something can be structured, but it's not going to be done with anything at all resembling the types of efficiencies that we've seen AHFC develop in its other programs. It's almost going to take a dollar for every dollar that's loaned if you're going to set it up and try to bond. The other thing is that it seems to me once you get into these larger ventures, you're no longer talking about individual home ownership as much as you're talking about a business, the business of being a landlord. And for the other businesses, which are financed through the Industrial Development Authority, the state is not providing a subsidy for those. If they don't qualify for tax-exempt financing, and we're seeing some ominous clouds in Washington, D.C. that may restrict tax-exempt financing for some of these, then they pay the market rate on taxable bonds. They pay the market rate on the tax-exempt bonds that we issue. There's no subsidy down to X percent or so many percentage points knocked off the bond cost. And it seems to me that when you get into this area, you really are talking business rather than home ownership. At least once you're into the large plexes, I don't know where you draw that line. But once you do cross that line, and it is there somewhere, then it's a business venture, it seems to me, and I don't think a subsidy is in order for that.
If I could comment on that just very briefly, Tom, the problem is, of course, that because we do subsidize, you know, single-family homes, and you're quite right about the business aspect, if we don't provide some means of reducing the renter's cost, we're going to be passing on a very high cost to that renter while subsidizing single-family, and somehow that seems very unfair to me.
It reminds me of the little Volkswagen commercial about the man who has the pizza deliveries, and he's telling about how he gets 50 miles to the gallon in his little rabbit, and says, "Wow, you must be able to pass those savings on to the customers." And his reaction is, "You must be kidding." Now, I'm not saying that all landlords are going to be that crass in their dealings with their renters. Obviously, they want to keep the units rented. And if they can pass savings along, I'm sure that a large portion of those savings will be passed along. But there's a natural, understandable human temptation to take some of those savings if they're available and not pass all of them on. I think there'll be some inefficiencies there. I was also going to say, perhaps with these other programs that we have, it may be that people who over time we'll be able to affect a transition from a renter status into a homeowner status. We do have the homeowner assistance program, and we do have the mobile home loan program. And these provide intermediate steps for people to make that transition out from mere renter status eventually into the pride of ownership of their own home.
Senator Sturgis.
Mr. Chairman, the municipality, of course, is working, trying to put together a package under the tax exempt, and you mentioned something that, even though done some staff work, there doesn't seem to be an easy answer, and that's the need to find that extra security so, in fact, you can go to the bond market. And one of the things we haven't really been able to get a hold on is both through ADA, AHFC, and possibly things that are held in handled by Treasury. Is there enough capacity there to in fact do this, or are we using all that capacity in the things that are handled within the various public agencies or within the state to provide the kind of backing that's needed? It's very difficult to get that answer. And we tend to put things off into little packages and not to be able to cut across those public authorities. Is there a way to do a good analysis to see, in fact, whether there's adequate financial resources there in some kind of a pooled basis so that we can get in and actually put together a package?
I think there's no doubt that there's capacity. It's a question of priority. We have an operating budget that's for this coming fiscal year that's going to be on the order of $1.8 billion or $1.9 billion or $1.6 billion, wherever it comes out, but under $2 billion. We're looking at $4 billion worth of revenue next year. Surely there's capacity that remains in the reserve.
Commissioner, I'm not talking about I'm talking about paper that exists. I'm not talking about just dollars, either in veterans loans, the capacity within AHFC on paper that may be there, any excess capacity to be used as, if you will, collateral that would allow that to happen. I'm not talking about tapping just dollars.
In terms of AHFC, I don't think the net worth of the corporation would be that substantial to get anything along these lines launched. There is a fairly substantial portfolio of illiquid loans that have been made in the past in the general fund, and they're basically excluded from the deliberations about what's available to appropriate, because it would probably be very difficult to sell those in a secondary market, and if you could, you'd take quite a discount from what the outstanding balance nominally is on those, because the interest rates are much lower than today's market rates. Also, maybe some of them have, maybe in some the opinion of the outside people who would probably be buying them, they might not look like the best credits. However, they do provide a regular source of income. They are seasoned loans, and even though they may not have a high market value, there is an income stream from them. It's built into the sources for the general fund. I recall it's on the order of $24 million a year is repaid out of those. That would be a cash flow. I don't know how that could be leveraged or used to provide that sort of security, but it might be that could provide coverage for up to $24 million a year of debt service, and or $20 million a year of debt service. And that would be a substantial principal amount.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just feel that's an area that does need to be explored. I think we may end up building several different sources of meeting this demand, and any that we can do without getting into a direct subsidy program, I think, would be obviously to our advantage.
Commissioner, just a brief comment regarding the Anchorage program. I worked with Mayor Knowles to help put the program together. It should go to the Assembly within the next 2 weeks or so. The probable amount of the issue will be $40 to $50 million for multifamily housing in Anchorage.
Commissioner, I think we're going to have to get moving. Before I give you a chance to make any closing comments, I do have one other question I'd like you to touch briefly on, and it's really worth the whole couple hours or 20 hours of itself, so don't go in too deeply, but you're also on the permanent fund board, and I'm just wondering if you perceive anything, any activity in regards to the permanent fund that could affect our deliberations here in terms of what the cost of the subsidy is going to be for AHFC.
what I'm saying is the permit fund going to be of any help in terms of taking any of the demand up so that we might not have to put so much into HFC?
Well, you're probably still going to have to put a comparable amount into AHFC because AHFC has an advantage in interest rates over what the permanent fund would be able to invest at. However, the permanent fund has, the Board of Trustees have authorized $25 million to be offered for reservation for people who, for one reason or other, don't want AHFC or whatever. And we've had some demand. As of the 31st of December, we held in the permanent fund $8,269,241.95 worth of loans and mortgages. Obviously, there's a substantial part of the $25 million that has not yet been committed or funded, but we have also developed, or are in the process of developing with our staff, a program of adjustable rate mortgages. One of the problems right now, and AHFC encounters this too, is the high cost of money for 20-year obligations or longer. You can market money with a 10-year maturity, but once you get much beyond that, the bondholders are really demanding a premium of at least a percentage point often in order to take the money that has that 20-year maturity. One of the ways that you can alleviate that situation is, in a sense, to let the rate be adjusted periodically. Then you're not locked into a fixed rate for a long period of time. If you have expectations that interest rates may continue to fluctuate or are generally on an upward trend as a long historic cycle, this allows you to ride that trend upward and take the fluctuations as they occur. Conversely, if you think you're at a peak and we're about to enter a long historic period of decline, which I don't subscribe to myself, then you'd want to lock in at long-term rates and have all kinds of protection so that you'd be assured of getting that high return over the years, even though it then was drifting out there ever higher and higher above where the market rates were actually at. The adjustable rates are a compromise between the two philosophies and essentially give you 30-year money, but it looks like a one-year maturity or a two-year maturity, whatever your period is for readjustment of the mortgages. It's a thing we're looking at. It has been tried in other places. It was originally developed in the savings and loan industry because they were so sorely strapped. And so we are looking at that. And I would expect that a program of adjustable rate mortgages will be created by the permanent fund. We will authorize, I would expect, more than the balance on the $25 million for the permanent fund. And perhaps it will be taken advantage of. We'll just have to wait and see on the market.
One other question that I shouldn't ask, but I will. Do you have any comment on some proposal that people have called me regarding right now that the limit, I think, is $147,000 for HFC in terms of the total loan, and $90,000 of which can be at the subsidized rate. And there's been some proposals to raise both the $90,000 to something else, which isn't really specified, and the raise the upper limit to something over $160,000. I think they were tying it to some other rate that's just gone up to 162 or something like that. I can't remember what rate they were talking about. Fannie Mae rate. So can you comment on that?
It's my recollection that at the last board meeting we did in fact authorize the higher limits so that the dollar amounts that may be financed have been increased. And I've forgotten the other part of your question.
The
90,000. Well, I don't know whether an ongoing program where the state is the sole source, the entire secondary market for housing mortgages, is essentially a healthy situation over the long term. AHFC is in this business now, has grown into it because of a crisis that was precipitated by federal monetary policy and by actions taken in Congress to largely end tax-exempt bond programs for housing mortgages. The legislature has responded and the corporation has responded, and the consequence is now that probably 98 or 99% of all the mortgage money in Alaska comes through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. That's all right in dealing with an emergency, with a short-term situation, but I think in the long haul, the state is better off not being that source of funds. I think we're better to let the secondary markets that naturally exist take over once interest rates return to a more stable level. We're not out of the woods yet, of course. In fact, the prime rate has just reversed itself again, which may be the harbinger of higher mortgage rates and conventional financing as well. So certainly there's a continued strong, important role for AHFC over the short and intermediate term. Over the long term, though, I think that probably we need to wean ourselves away from AHFC and perhaps leave it to deal with special areas of housing financing problems the way it was created originally. And this $90,000 limitation is one market way of weaning people away from dependency on subsidized housing mortgages. So I would recommend keeping it.
Thank you very much. We do have several other people testify. Unless you have any closing remarks, we should keep going.
Thank you.
I have left on my list here